Okay. We've now called the assembly to order. Today we have had 161 members as of January, and today in the last week we had our first resignation. Paula Barakat has not been with us for the last few weeks and just simply indicated no other reason but she just can't make the meetings, and so we've had one resignation. When you think about it, 161 persons, January 12, and today we have 160, one resignation in that eight-month period. That is absolutely phenomenal. So we have 160 members, and four of that are not with us today. So we have 156 of 160 members, and this is absolutely phenomenal, and I think indicates the kind of dedication and commitment that our members have. The people who are away are Caroline Fader, and as you know, she's recovering from surgery. Evelyn Morrison and Sylvia Williams and Glenn McKinnon are both on leaves of absence looking after their spouse. We have a birthday today. We always have birthdays most days, but we have one birthday today. Linda, where are you? There, it's Linda's birthday today. Happy birthday, Linda. And I know I did remember it. Ralph's birthday was yesterday. In the audience, we have Harry Neufeld, Chief Electoral Officer. Harry Neufeld is with us today, along with his colleague, Linda Johnson, who's with us almost every weekend. And welcome back to Andre Blais from the University of Montreal. Andre, good to have you here. We'll make you sing for your lunch or something like that later. And, of course, visiting us almost every weekend, again from the University of Montreal, Patrick Fournier is with us today. Leslie Seidel, Senior Research Associate, Institute for Research on Public Policy in Montreal. Where are you, Leslie? Right there. Good to have you here. Janet Erasmus, Senior Member of the Legislative Council, Attorney General's Office. You are here, Janet, right? Right there. Good. I also want to thank the members of the public. Certain members of the public have been here, I think, virtually every meeting throughout, and we really appreciate your being here, and we hope that you're here for our next two meetings as well. Now, I approached an idea on, I think it was January 12th when we first met, and I talked about the idea of these ordinary British Columbians becoming somewhat extraordinary for a number of reasons, and I want to revisit that because I use that in every presentation I give. I always say I am honored to be here on behalf of 160 extraordinary British Columbians. I want to state that again for reasons which I think are so important for today. And, you know, I think the intention of the government was to appoint ordinary British Columbians, that is, British Columbians that were non-elected, that represented the diversity of B.C., but through the process of random invitation, such that you didn't belong to any organization, you're not here representing a regional district or an association, a professional association, you're here representing yourself and the citizens of B.C. And there was also a self-selection process such that only those who are really committed to serving the community came. But then the government did a number of things. They gave you a very important task to review our voting system, a very important public policy task. Then they went and did something else. They gave you independence, absolutely total independence. And I can tell you, and you know yourselves, we have been every bit as independent as the government had wanted us to be. We have had no suggestions from any bureaucrats or from any person holding political office. We've been totally independent. So they've given us that. And then, on top of that, they gave us a certain power. They gave us the power, if we so wish to recommend a change, a power to recommend that will go straight to the people of British Columbia, not filtered through the government of B.C., but a question that would go straight to the people of B.C. This has never happened before. And overall, what it shows that if you take a group of citizens and give them something very important to do, and if you trust them, they will do absolutely phenomenal things. They will rise to that occasion and do absolutely wonderful things. So this is a very good lesson in democratic governance that this province and other provinces and I think other democracies in the world can use. It does carry major responsibility, however. You don't have all that trust and independence without responsibility. The commensurate responsibility, of course, is to work as an assembly. and to pull together as an assembly, to have our differences, make sure they're differences of opinion, make sure they're clear, but at the end of the day, that we are united behind the process and behind our decisions. And I have been asked, you've heard it very many times, if we do make a recommendation, we're still speculating, we will not know that until tomorrow, but if we do make a recommendation that will go to a referendum to the people of British Columbia, some worry then, how can we ensure that we get the public support for that? Like, we've debated this, we've worked on it, we've studied it. How does one get the public support? I really do believe, and many, many others who are probably much more expert than I, is the variable, the condition that's going to affect whether or not the public support us is more in your hands than anyone else's hands in all of British Columbia. The people of British Columbia will support your decision, whatever the decision is, almost to the full extent that you yourselves are united behind that decision. That when we leave, it's important that we are cohesive on the process. We've all committed to the process, and that we all confirm that what we've done together, and we go out as a united assembly. I'd also want to make one other comment. And again, I ought to probably not to be making this. I'm not anticipating the decision at all, but I'm responding slightly to some of your comments and to some comments we've had in the press about the two systems that we are looking at, as two alternatives, STV and MMP, and how complicated they are. It is, I believe, very important when we choose one of these over the two, and then we go into Sunday morning and make a decision, however that decision will work out, that we ensure, of course, we describe these from the point of the view of the voter who goes into the voting booth. These are not complicated at all. The system we have now, one of its strengths, is it's very simple. You go in the voting booth and you mark an X. The other systems that we have, one of them, let's say you live in Kelowna, we have an STV system, you'll go into the voting booth and you'll choose three people and you'll rank them 1, 2, 3. That's pretty simple. The other system we're looking at, if you're still in the same place and you're voting, you will go into a voting booth and you'll have two votes. One for the local constituency, one for the party. That's pretty simple. So those people who say that these are complex, I think certainly underestimate the intelligence of British Columbians. Other places in this world have been using these systems for over 20 years, sometimes up to 80 and 90 years, in 20, 30, 40, 50 countries, and no one's going to convince me that British Columbians aren't at least as smart and intelligent and as wise as the people in the other countries. So, however we come to those decisions. I would now like your approval of the agenda with the following caveats. We're going to have to be very flexible today. The agenda more or less indicates the order of things as they will be discussed, how long we're going to spend on some of these, whether or not the first vote will be at 4 o'clock or earlier or later or 2 o'clock next tomorrow morning is going to depend on how discussion goes. And Bob, you're laughing. It might take that time. So they are just suggestive. The other last thing I'm going to mention about the agenda is that after Ken gives us an overview of decisions last week and STV and MMP, we're going into discussion groups. We will stay in discussion groups all morning. The agenda says we're going to come back here before noon. We're not. We're going to stay in discussion groups all morning, and then we'll come back here at 1:15. And the plan, unless you direct me differently, will be to stay here in plenary and work towards a decision, our first decision. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. I will now turn it over to Professor Carty.
Thank you, Jack. Is this on? Yes, I guess it is. First thing we wanted to do this morning, really following the model from last week, is just to kind of review the package of decisions or tentative decisions we made around MMP. Remember that we spent a lot of time last weekend building an MMP alternate model, and we went through a kind of a whole series of decisions. It's useful just to kind of pause, take our breath, look at what that package looks like. Look at, there's still some details to be fleshed in, and really just remind ourselves of that and make sure that In recording those decisions, we have it right. So we just want to take a few minutes to do that, and if people have comments on that, we can take them. Well, we were talking about a mixed constituency party system for British Columbia, and we made a series of decisions, and the important ones, I think, establishing what the principles of this system would look like and the core decisions. The fundamental principle is that this would be a proportional system, not some kind of light or compensatory system. And the Assembly's view was that it ought to be about a 60-40 split between constituency seats and list seats. The Assembly decided that in this tentative model that candidates would be free to run in one or both of the parts of the system. So that one could be a candidate in a constituency and on a list, but it wouldn't be required that you do so, and people wouldn't be constrained from running in both sides. Then there was the question of how many votes, and some MMP systems restrain that kind of choice by saying there should be just one vote, and we'll count the constituency vote as the partisan vote. The Assembly said no, in the interest of voter choice, they wanted to ensure there'd be two votes, one for each side of the system that was being put together. In terms of district seats, the decision seemed to be in favor of the alternate vote, again, I think on a voter choice kind of basis. The decision was to have proportional allocation at the provincial level so that the seats won would reflect the provincial share of the votes that particular parties received. Party lists, and here there was quite a vigorous discussion, it seemed to me, and the decision of the Assembly was that the list should be regionalized so that members would know that some members from the list side of the system would come from at least their region of the province. But those lists would be open. And so voters would have some opportunity to, in some way, indicate which candidates on those lists that they preferred. Thresholds, you recall we had a debate between the natural threshold and various other alternatives, and the Assembly hit on 3% as the desirable threshold. And on the question of vacancies, it was a decision that at least on the list side, that they should be replaced in by-elections by the same principle that chose them in the first instance. Question on vacancies for lists was partially decided in the sense that there seemed to be a broad consensus that the seat should belong to the party that had won it in the general election, but exactly what that mechanism would be was still to be determined. But the principled kind of decision had been taken. Well, there's a few other, we might say, second-order decisions about this system that still remain. I don't think, frankly, any of them are likely to affect the basic principles that structured this kind of system. Questions about list access, the notorious, the infamous Italian problem, some of us have called it. The question is exactly which formula for doing the mathematical calculations on PR. Question of overhang seats. Probably a little bit more likely when you're using a list assignment of seats, exactly how to fill those list vacancies, what the ballot papers might look like, basic ballot forms, and then, of course, the question of the number of regions. And the number of regions is likely to have some impact on the lists and on access and questions of overhang and so on. So these things are intertwined. Now, I guess the question is, have we got this system right? Basically, we're talking about a system that's going to work pretty much like the German system. Same kind of principle, proportionality, national allocations, regional assignments. And so if you kind of were to look at a textbook to look at something that was as close, probably the German kind of MMP as opposed to other people's kinds would come closer to what the Assembly hit on. But there were two very important BC modifications that will change it in significant ways in terms of how it works for candidates and parties. First of all, it would be an open list, and of course quite how those lists would be selected would remain to be decided, but the principle of the open list is there. The Germans don't do that, of course, they use closed lists, and the decision to have the alternate vote in constituency seats. So those are significant changes and modifications to reflect maybe a different BC. And as I say, there are still a few issues needing resolution. They basically, it seems to me, don't speak to the principles. Now, I guess the question is this a kind of faithful account of what we've got, and have we established what we need to be able to make a decision about an MMP alternative? we need to speak any more about that? I never heard this room so quiet. Okay, well, then I will take it that in some sense we're reporting and that there's no kind of misrepresentation. This is where we are and that we have enough information. We have a clear enough model with principles clearly articulated so that we can use this as a basis for comparison to other systems. Right? Okay. All right. Let's close that one for the moment and come and talk about what we need to talk about today. Well, this morning and through the rest of the day, we've got these alternative systems and essentially we have to assess them and make some decisions as to which one might be the best alternative that we could come up for from British Columbia. That's, in some sense, the Assembly's task. So we've got two systems. And they're based on different approaches to organizing electoral competition. They're based on different approaches to voter choice. So that there are principal differences between them in terms of their very essence. One is, as we say, a mixed member proportional system. One's a single transferable vote type. And we use this notion of type or family to kind of recognize that they may meet similar institutional criteria. They may do some of the same kinds of things that you've identified as important, but they're going to do them in different ways. And the underlying principles are different. And so there's a real choice here. This is, you can't sort of tweak one and make it look like the other and vice versa because they do operate from different bases. And each of these models that you've built, it seems to me, has been modified in ways that, in fact, reflect the realities of this province. And so the single transferable vote doesn't look like they may use that in some other place. And the MMP system, we said a minute ago, doesn't exactly look like anybody else's because British Columbia doesn't look like any other place. And that's important if we're going to have a system that works for this province and its society in the future. And both are likely, frankly, to produce different legislative and governing dynamics. Different from what we have now, but obviously different from each other because they're based on different kind of underlying principles. And if one or other of these is adopted as an alternative to the system, politics and government in this province won't be the same. We know we can't always predict how it will be, but we know it won't be the same. So we're talking about not only changing an electoral system, but changing an important institutional piece that will fundamentally change the way politics operates if we adopt such a system. So as I said, STV and MMP are different in principle from first past the post and from each other. And I think that's important to keep that in mind. The principles that make it different. You know, we can talk about the details if we want and the plumbing, but it's really the fundamental principles that we need to keep an eye on because that's, at the end of the day, what's going to guide a decision. And it's true, that, and we've seen that for the last 2 weeks, that the plumbing looks pretty complicated. You know, we had to make a whole lot of decisions about a number of what looked like pretty technical kinds of questions. But the reality is that all electoral systems have this kind of complicated plumbing. I don't know how many of you have actually read this very fine document. It's 160 pages of excellent small print. There is a section on page 84, I know, that will warm the heart of Brad. Section 48 has two subsections, and that's what happens if there's a tie. But there's 160, 170 pages of fine print that's the plumbing of the existing system. So we shouldn't worry about the fact that other systems also have this kind of detail. All systems have it. And decisions about electoral systems need to rest not on this kind of detail, but on the kind of the principles that underlie it, that are at the base of what the system is trying to do and what's important. And rest on the implications for representation and the implications for government, and not the technical details. So as I say, I think it's important we try and think about the principles and not the plumbing. The plumbing's important. It's the way that these principles are articulated. It's the way they will work. They will govern that, and the details of that, as we've often said, do make a difference. But we need to know what they make a difference for and why and what we're interested in. So if we think about this problem of choosing electoral systems, we know that we start from some kind of basic value positions. Our conceptions of fairness, our conceptions of citizenship, our conceptions of representation, all those kinds of things. And One of the reasons we can't say what is, that I can't say in the question that Douglas asked me in the first week, is there a best system for BC? Well, if I was to answer that, I would just be telling you about my values. And we're not engaged in just trying to figure out what my values are, or Doug's values are, or Craig's, or Priya's, or Leanne's here. We're interested in trying to work out whether we collectively know what the values of British Columbia and its society are. And that's why an assembly of this kind of size is important, to hear those kind of conflicting and agreeing value positions. Those values, of course, have to work through some basic electoral system, of which some basic political system, of which the electoral system is only one small part. You know, we know that the Westminster parliamentary system is an essential element of our political system, and our mandate says we take that for granted. We operate within that framework, and so questions like electing the premier, which some people raised early on, are just outside the mandate because we're only looking at one part of those, of that political system. And we're operating within the context of the Constitution of Canada, which has some implications for the kind of representational politics and assemblies we might have. Well, so taking those values and pushing them through a kind of existing political system, if we want to play with some small part, leads us to the question about, well, what institutional features do we want to see in an electoral system, in that part of our political system? And the assembly has hit on these three basic ones. Other features are important to people and become part of the decision, but there was a kind of recognition there were three big kind of macro-level features that seem to be important: voter choice, proportional representation, and local representation. And all members of the assembly obviously don't agree on the relative weight of that. That's why no one individual can say what the best system is, because in some sense it's the collective weighing of those important criteria, those features of a system that you have to be engaged in. And finally, that leads you then to two kind of electoral system possibilities as alternatives. And so in some sense, when you think about the choices, the farther back you can push yourself into values, the closer maybe we can get to the kind of principles. But that's the kind of chain of reasoning that essentially we've been through, in the kind of, in some sense, hierarchy of considerations perhaps that is involved. So let's think about these three key institutional features that you've identified and check to see whether these two alternative systems in some sense meet them. We discover they meet them in different ways. MMP provides for more voter choice, or a kind of voter choice, in two ways. And it does it in two distinct, separate parts of the system that then have to get pulled together in the final total. And it does it by providing for voters the opportunity to vote for a candidate in a defined electoral district, but also for a particular political party. STV, we know, allows for voter choice in a different kind of way. It allows you voters to rank candidates. First, second, third preference, unconstrained by their party ties. So you could vote 1, 2, 3 all in the same party, or you could vote 1, 2 for one party and perhaps give a third preference to another party, or any number of combinations. And so it allows for a more sophisticated ordering of preferences than the current system. So both of them seem to provide for voter choice, but different kinds of choices in different kinds of ways. MMP provides for proportional representation, that's the point of it, through topping up a system which with people is disproportional. The constituency side is disproportional, so you make it proportional by this top-up arrangement. And that's, I guess, if one had to think about it, a system that's more party-centered. The definition of proportionality and the way voters get at it is by voting for parties. So it's a more party-centered kind of proportionality, I guess. STV is different because voters choose candidates, and through the selection of candidates and the rank ordering, the preferences and the existence of multi-member districts provide for what we might identify as just different from MMP as a more candidate-centered way of getting to proportional representation. But both are designed to get to proportional representation. How closely they get to it is a function, of course, of the numbers of parties that are competing and some of the plumbing details, but both of them basically get to proportionality in about the same way and to about the same kind of degree, or can get to it in about the same kind of degree. In terms of meeting the third criteria of local representation, MMP does it by providing for single-member local districts as well as regional lists, or your version provides for regional lists. Other people's provide for national. So you get some local members, and then you get these regional members. A single transferable vote provides for that particular institutional feature by providing for multi-member local districts. So all members are in local districts, but they are multi-member districts. So all three of them, both of these systems seem to meet all three of the criteria, but they do each of them in different kind of ways. And there are sort of different kind of principles underlying those differences. So if we think about these systems and the relationship to the MLAs, the people who were chosen to represent us in the Legislative Assembly, in the Parliament, we see there are some differences. With MMP, voters will have a local MLA from a slightly larger constituency than they have now, and their party will have a proportionate share of seats in the legislature. Voters will also have list members. They may not, of course, depending on how the mathematics work out, necessarily have a list member from their preferred party in their region. I mean, there's no guarantee of that. But your party overall will have its proportionate share because of the regionalization. That doesn't necessarily mean that it'll come from your region. So if you're a supporter of the Millionaires Party, you know, the one that's headquartered in Gold River, and they win enough to win one seat, it can only come from one region, and it might be your region, it might not. So you don't know. With STV, voters will have several representatives from larger districts, a little bit larger districts than MMP probably, and their voters are very likely, almost certain, to have representatives from more than one party in their district. That's a proportionality. So if you're in a district, you probably have, under the current system, you might have a couple of liberals and a new Democrat, and maybe a green or something, in appropriate proportions. So you could have members from either party to go to that would represent your local interests. In both systems, it's important to remember that the number of MLAs from a particular region of the province will not change. There's no reason why it is. So if the Okanagan, for instance, was defined as a particular region, it has so many seats now, that number isn't going to change by adopting one of these systems. It may change as population figures change over time, but the systems won't change it. But they will be organized differently. With MMP, 60% of them will come from local districts, 40% from the wider region. From STV, all of them will come from separate multi-member districts. So it's perhaps important for many people to kind of keep that in mind. Well, let's think about the Westminster parliamentary system for a minute. This is my best attempt, Amanda. Why did they close the blinds?
I understand they close the blinds because they get better resolution from the cameras which are taking photos. Is that correct? The glare? Marilyn, could you please tell us why they close the blinds?
The sun was right in Fred's eyes here, and he asked specifically.
Okay,
Fred, I thought it was because you didn't want to miss one of my goals.
I wonder let's talk about it. We might ask Fred to kind of stay, be in another place. There's a lot of people would like the blinds open, so we'll discuss that later. I will chat with Fred and see if we can find a better way to resolve the problem.
I'm sure the sun will change and everything will be all right again shortly.
We'll leave it for now. Yes, Susan?
It's not just Fred. There's a glass across the street there, and there's a horrendous glare from that.
Okay. We'll look at that this afternoon. Thank you.
That was the sunshine.
Doesn't the sun always shine in Vancouver? Apparently not.
Reflective sunshine.
FW. I can't hear you.
Why don't we just close one and open the others?
We're not going to be here all that long.
They're shaking their heads.
We will do this afternoon. Carry on.
Okay. Settle down, class. Apparently not. Okay. This picture is my best attempt and my very limited PowerPoint skills to kind of remind us about the Westminster parliamentary system. And we've got at one end the electoral process producing a legislature and then a government coming out of that legislature. But notice that the electoral process, this is my kind of symbolic representation, the electoral process and the governments don't touch. Right? And I think that's what I'm trying to say, that elections don't choose governments in our system. That's a fundamental difference, right? The legislatures do. Now, if a government wins, if a party wins a majority, it becomes sort of automatic. Those are the conventions. But technically, the elections don't choose the government. They choose a legislature. And they determine the shape of that legislature. And the electoral system translates those votes that come out of the Voting Act into the legislature. And government policy is then dependent upon the legislature's support. Now, what kind of ties that together and so allows voters, in fact, to choose governments or to have some role in choosing governments is the role that political parties play in providing a kind of organizational coherence. So politicians get together and say, look, if we run as a team, you know, then we'll win a majority in the legislature and then we'll be able to control the government in the simplest ways. And in British Columbia, proportional representation systems, whether they're MMP or STV, are likely to produce legislatures with no single party majority. And I say that only because, with one exception, that's been the case since for as far back as you can look in the history books. The last election, there was actually a majority of voters, and so under any system, it was going to produce a majority in the legislature. But every other time, with the current party system, the majority that came out of the government was created by the electoral system. And so it's very likely that we would have had, under a proportional system, a series of legislatures with no clear majorities. So one wants to, if that's the kind of the context, the kind of framework of thinking about the Westminster system, we want to ask, how will parties and the legislatures create, maybe differ a little bit under these two systems? This gets us to some of the principles of governing that we need to think about. Well, let's start by remembering that parliamentary government is party government. You know, that politicians have incentives to come together to work as parties, both electoral incentives, so it's more efficient to gather votes that way, and it's more efficient then to operate legislatures that way. And that whatever the electoral system that has been used in any working mass democracy, by mass I mean simply the mass of the population has a vote, the political parties exist to solve all kinds of aggregation problems. And in both systems, STV or MMP, serious parties are going to be disciplined. I mean, that's the point of having a party, to kind of create a team that works together as opposed to other teams. And, of course, some kind of discipline is also the price of power. So whatever impact these systems have on party discipline, and they will have some impact, and they will have some impact on the way those things work, we're not going to abolish party discipline by adopting one of these kinds of systems. We may change its dynamic. We may change, you know, what levels and who has influence on that. But we are going to be in a system of party government with disciplined parties. At least parties that are serious about winning office and forming coalitions are going to be disciplined because it's in their advantage to do it. So in proportional systems, the challenge of leaders is in some way to find ways to kind of hold those teams together, hold their parties together in both cooperative relationships, because they have to cooperate probably with other parties to form coalitions and to form governments, but also to engage in competitive politics. So the parties are now engaged in two kinds of games that are somewhat different from our kind of system, both competitive and cooperative games. So those are the kind of realities that are going to be, I think, in play whichever system is chosen. Well, we can think about what this means for party competition a little bit and what those comparisons might look like. Both systems are likely to lead to more competition, to more competitors. In one of the so-called the laws of political science is that proportional representation is going to produce more competition because parties suddenly realize that there's a chance. Under the current system, parties come to the conclusion that unless they form big parties, and famous French political scientist named Maurice de Bourget said inevitably two, they're not likely to win, that the electoral system doesn't allow them. But under proportionality, if you get 10% of the votes, you can get 10% of the seats. And so you don't have to merge yourself with another big party. Remember, that's what happened in this country just about a year ago. The Conservatives and the Alliance merged. It's not because they loved each other. It's because they wanted to be together. It's because they thought that if they didn't, they wouldn't get an appropriate share of votes and they would so-called split the vote. If there had been a proportional system, they wouldn't have had to do that. We wouldn't have had to have this kind of marriage or living together or whatever they're doing. Right? And so the logic is that under proportional representation, there probably will be more competitors because people think, well, now I have a chance. And it's and if I can have an organization, a party that will appeal to 10 or 15%, we can get our share of the votes and make our positions clear and get our voices into the legislature. So, and we know in proportional systems there are more parties. There are more parties competing, and there are more parties in the legislature. How many of them? Who can't predict. Who they're likely to be? You can't predict. Those kind of questions are for ultimately the voters decide, and it will settle down after a couple of elections fairly quickly as a new system emerges. And we'll talk a little bit in comparison to FTP, FPTP about that tomorrow morning. MMP, I suppose we could say, will aid small parties because it's a party-oriented system. STB will aid smaller parties. It will also make it possible, we know, for independents to run in a way that's more difficult under STV. And so we're likely to get under MMP, we're likely to get under STV as well some independents running and maybe even some getting elected. Some STV systems had a fair number of independents elected, others not. Again, that kind of will be for the voters to decide in the end. So these parties will have to learn how to balance this competitive relationship with one another on election day with then a notion that they're going to have to actually cooperate as soon as the election's over. And some of them may decide to announce their preferred cooperation partners before the election to kind of give a signal to voters. Others may not. They'll say, vote for us, and then we'll do what's in the best interest of the voters that we speak for. Now, whether that parliamentary dynamic is center-seeking, so that parties kind of move to more to the center or form coalitions that are more center-based or more consensual, or whether it's likely to produce a more polarized kind of dynamic, it's not possible to tell. May do one at one time and one at another. If we have two big parties and a small party in the middle and neither of the big parties has a majority, they both may have an incentive to try and make a deal with a more centrist party and move more to the center to form a coalition. But if the small parties are out on the extremes, they need to find some coalition partner. Maybe they'll be pulled to the extreme. So they can be pulled to the center or pulled to the ends. And there's no guarantee under PR system what's that likely to be. So you could have center-seeking or extremist kinds of coalitions coming up under different circumstances. And it may vary from legislature to legislature in terms of the balance of party strength. And that will only reflect the balance of voter strength. So what differences might we expect in some of these systems? In terms of electoral competitors and electoral competition, it might be fair to say that the electoral interests and the electoral campaigns of list members and constituency members are likely to vary somewhat, even within the same party. I mean, if you're a list candidate in a particular political party, you're probably only going to get elected if your party doesn't win too many constituencies. So you have some kind of, ambivalence about that. There's a certain kind of tension between those candidates, and list candidates may prefer to find constituencies because they are potentially more safe. In STV, competition is often explicitly between candidates of the same party for local support. If there's a district of four members and the Liberals say, well, we're pretty sure we're going to win two of these seats because that would be our proportionate share, that would be our fair share, because we're probably going to have about half the votes. But we'll run three or four candidates anyway, because that's how many seats there are. Those Liberal candidates are going to think, well, we've got to take votes away from the other parties, but if I want to get elected, and Nick's my running mate, I want to get more Liberal votes than Nick, so you're in a competition with him as well as with candidates of other parties. So both parties produce kind of internal dynamics that there are different interests at work. In MMP, candidates' electoral appeals are probably more likely to be oriented to party policy because in a formal sense they're competing with the other parties. In STV, candidates' electoral appeals tend to be a bit more oriented to kind of the personal service that they're providing for voters. I mean, if Nick and I have to campaign for the same kind of Liberal votes, we're going to do it partly not by saying, well, I'm a better liberal or he's a better liberal, because we're both going to say we're good liberals or good greens or good marijuana users or whatever we're going to be good at. No. But we're going to go to voters and say, well, I'm going to take better care of you, and they're going to work harder at doing that. So STB tends to produce members who are oriented to campaigning in that mode because they can't, because they know they're partly running against their own running mates as well as candidates of other parties, and they have to do it partly by providing a service to voters. At least that seems to be the experience of these systems. Well, as legislative organizations, they are going to be somewhat different. MMP produces an MMP party is going to have two kinds of MLAs. Going to have the constituency MLAs and the regional MLAs with different political bases and different obligations. And one might think, well, that's a good thing because they're going to be oriented in different ways and that's going to cover more responsibilities. In STV, all MLAs are going to have the same constituency base and the same responsibilities. This is the difference between the so-called two types of MLAs. In STV, they're all basically the same. In MMP, you've got these two kinds of MLAs. In the legislature, MMP is likely also to produce not only two kinds of members, but two kinds of parties, when you think through the arithmetic of it. The large parties are probably going to be parties that have done very well at the constituency level. And so the big parties tend to be dominated by constituency members. And particularly the government party almost always has a majority of members elected from constituencies because they've done well at the constituency level. That's the kind of definition of a big party. So governing parties are disproportionately full of constituency members doing most of that kind of work. The very small parties are probably not going to win very many constituency seats. That's the definition of a small party. And so the small parties are going to be mostly made up of list members. So not only are there different kinds of members, but you tend to get then some parties that are doing all the constituency kind of stuff, some that are more list-oriented. And that can produce different kinds of dynamics. We've seen that emerge in New Zealand. In STV, we've got a lot of MLAs who are kind of trapped between establishing and maintaining party loyalty and party discipline, but also the need to make sure that they are more in tune with their voters. And their tension is, in some sense, in the legislature, between the party local voter kind of connection. And MLAs have to walk that kind of line, and that can make it difficult for themselves and for their leaders as they operate as legislative caucuses that way. Parties in governments. Well, the reality is that very soon that the parties are going to have to learn that they will be in a different kind of system. Now when we get in the odd time when we get minority governments nationally or in various provinces, parties assume, well, this is the mistake. Obviously, our system is supposed to produce majorities, so we'll have a minority, but we'll just struggle along as long as necessary, then we'll have another election, and then the voters will do the right thing and return a majority. So under the current system, parties don't have much incentive to think about forming coalitions. They have to think about, they mostly think about getting to the next election as quickly as they can to get a majority. Under PR, there's no incentive to do that because the next election isn't going to produce a majority. It's not going to, you know, they can't trick the voters into giving them a majority. So there isn't a lot of incentive to form minority governments. Parties have incentive to think hard about forming coalitions that will be stable, that will be coherent, and that will last for some time. And so it takes a while for them to figure that out, but very soon we're going to be into not minority government kind of politics. That's really kind of the politics of our kind of system when FPTP doesn't work. The logic of MMP and STV is that if there are minority parliaments to form coalitions and then can stay in office, one would hope, for the duration of that legislature. This will mean, and I think Ian McKinnon spoke about this very effectively in his presentation to the Assembly on the first day, that some of the simple rules of government formation and defeat in the traditional Westminster process, the one that we've used from now, are going to have to evolve to provide for the processes of forming these coalitions. The parties are going to have to learn how to do that. In that process, there's going to be some evolution in the Westminster parliamentary rules that we use. And New Zealanders have had to do that. When they adopted an MMP system, they suddenly realized that, oh, it wasn't automatically majority governments all the time, and so there was going to be coalitions. And they maintained the same basic parliamentary system, but they've had to modify some of those kinds of rules and to about how you form governments and how you defeat them. You know, simple-minded, all for, all against kind of processes have to give way perhaps to more subtle kinds of arrangements. We certainly know that if we look at MMP or SDV systems, in all those, parties have proved to be effective partners. They make coalition governments work. And there's no reason to think that governments wouldn't work if either of those systems was adopted in British Columbia. Certainly there's no comparative reason to think that would be the case. The kinds of governments we're likely to get will depend largely on the kinds of parties the voters choose. And that will reflect the kind of the strength of the appeals to the voters. And then on the capacity of the partisan politicians who are elected to the legislature to kind of sit down and make arrangements with one another and build working coalitions. And that, you know, they're not, maybe not likely to get it right the first round. You know, New Zealand they did. They got just what they didn't expect. But by the second time they figured, oh, we're in a new game. And they begun to work it out. Party governments. Well, we can say a little bit about party governments. There's a lot of fine print up here. Both systems have produced party governments. And the shape of governments, as I just said, reflects the kind of the patterns of support that the voters produce. And as that changes, so will the patterns of government. Neither one of these systems produces a pattern that's fixed in stone forever. And I've just picked four examples at random, tried to use sort of national colors up there, point to four places where these systems have been used where the pattern of government has changed quite a lot in just the last decade or so because the patterns of the voters have changed. In the Australian Capital Territory, for instance, which uses an STV system, it had for some time many parties with coalition governments, even a couple minorities when they were first using that kind of system. And so they had a kind of pattern of lots of parties, lots of coalitions going along governing the capital territory. And it very recently shifted to majority governments. And they have majority governments there because the voters are now giving a majority to one of those parties. It's nothing to do with the logic of the electoral system. It has to do with what the voters had decided. In Ireland, for most of the 20th century, they had a pattern of one big party versus all the rest. So you could either have this one big party in majority, or you could have a coalition of all the others. And the one big party won almost all the time. A party called Fianna Fáil, loosely translated as the Soldiers of Destiny. What a name for a political party, eh? Growing out of the Irish Revolution. And that pattern persisted for two or three generations, and it's given away in the last decade to multi-party coalition politics. Because that party has eroded and other movements have grown up and voters have said we want to do it differently and some independents have come on the scene. And so they've moved away from this kind of bipolar choice between these big guys versus a coalition of the others to now a more multi-party coalition looking set of options. Similar kinds of things have happened in MMP systems in Germany. There were, for decades after the Second World War, basically three-party competition. Two big parties with a smaller party in the middle, quite a smaller party in the middle, getting 4, 5, 6% of the vote. And which of those big parties got to be in government depended on who the small party would make a deal with. So they both had an incentive. There was Social Democrats out here and the Christian Democrats out there. And they both had an incentive to try and make a deal with the small center party in the middle, the Free Democrats, so they could be in government. So that was a kind of center-seeking kind of coalition, and that small party was able to use its influence and its potential government-making capacity. It was a kind of a slightly tail-wagging the dog kind of arrangement to kind of produce a system that moved the big parties into a more centrist kind of orientation. Recently, though, that pattern has given away. There's been the growth of other parties, the Greens and some other parties, with the merger of East Germany into the system made it more complicated. And now, basically, Germans are facing a kind of multi-party system in which there are two big possible coalitions. There's a kind of left-side coalition and a right-side coalition made up of different combinations of parties in those coalitions. So it went from a kind of center-seeking alternative down to a more polarized. But at election time, voters know that which parties are on which side of this divide, and they can vote for it. And if they want to vote for the left side of the coalition, they can decide which part of that left side of the coalition they would like to be stronger by casting their vote for one part of it. In New Zealand, the first election produced an unexpected coalition of what I would call the ambitious, not what anyone expected, not what the politicians said they would do before the election, but the election result produced outcomes that no one had anticipated, and it took them a month or so to figure out, and they produced a coalition that no one expected. But by the next election period, a more polarized coalition alternatives of sort of left versus right in a crude kind of way, dominated by Labour with some small parties or by the New Zealand National Party and some small parties, is really what most New Zealanders now believe are their options. And so what we've got are lots of different possible combinations, and they will change over time as the voters change and as new parties come or old parties die or parties split or parties merge. And in all those cases, those shifts were driven by underlying political alignments that the electoral system reflected into the legislature, not created somehow artificially by the way the electoral system translated votes. And the governments they produced and supported then flowed from those changes in the electorates. So this really just, I guess, leads us to the problem that you now have to face of choosing. I think it's worth remembering a couple of things. The electoral system is only one part of the political system. You know, it's one part of a parliamentary system, and the parliamentary system is one part of a larger constitutional system. And if the province has any problems, and I'm not here to say there are any problems whatsoever, but if you think there are in its politics, changing the electoral system isn't going to fix them all, and it's certainly not going to fix them overnight. So we're talking about one part that will change the system, but like any other part, it's not a cure-all, you know, for warts or unemployment or all the other kind of things that people rightly are worried about. Politicians and parties will adapt to whatever system they have. I mean, that's their nature and that's their business. They will understand that the current system gives them incentives to do certain kind of things and constrains them from doing other kinds of things. A different system will change those incentives and those constraints. And they will adapt to operate in that new system, because if they don't adapt, they will lose, and they're not keen on that. Most of them aren't. I would say it'll probably take two or three electoral cycles before the system kind of settles down, because voters need to kind of come to understand the new dynamics. Politicians have to understand the new dynamics. New legislative norms have to grow. And certainly I think the experience in New Zealand, which changed its system in the 1990s, it was really after about the third election that it really became kind of clear how that system is likely to work. The first one produced hiccups and uncertainties, and politicians operated. But it's kind of settled down, and it's now kind of working like they thought it was going to work, I think. But it takes a cycle or two. I think it's probably worth remembering that everything you predict that's going to happen probably won't. And some things that you think are going to happen won't, as I say. Some things you haven't thought of probably will happen. I mean, that's the nature of designing big institutional features and then letting, you know, 3 million voters and 89 politicians kind of go at it and interact and work out in practice. I think at the end of the day, if you're clear on the basic principles of what you want, then the details will follow, right? You know kind of what the details will be, how they'll work, and really what's important is what kind of principles and what kind of representational politics you want. And if you can be clear about that, then I think the choosing should be a bit easier. And I envy you all your vote.
Yeah, we will take a couple of questions just of clarification. We're not going to start the debate, okay, guys? That happens in your discussion groups. But Brad has a question of clarification.
Ken, on your slide that was titled STV, MMP, and Party Competition, that one, why do you not suggest that independents also have a good chance through MMP with our constituency side and AV voting system?
Well, we know that independents have very little chance now under our system. It's a question of size. It's a question of cost. Running against political parties. They're almost going to have no chance on a list system, on the list part. on the constituency part, these are going to be bigger constituencies. The operating principles are going to be, they'll be a little different, you're right about AV, but basically the fundamental operating principles are not going to be so different as far as candidates are concerned, the kind of campaigns they can run, than they are under the current first-past-the-post plurality system. There's no evidence that they have much chance. I mean, there are exceptions. We saw one in the last federal election in Surrey here, but these are rarer than hen's teeth now, and I think that the chances of independence are extraordinarily limited under that kind of system.
We have four more questions of clarification. I will urge you, these are questions of clarification. Any speeches and this hook that I told you about does come and it does take you away. Will.
Thank you, Mike. My question is, do you think that before we vote on these two systems, we should know the size and number of the regions? Because, for example, in the Day submission, he describes a region whose boundaries are the Northwest Territories, Yukon border, down to the American border, and that's one region. So in order, if we're to choose, if we're to know what kind of regional representation we might have, we must know the size and number of the regions.
That kind of, I agree, Wilf, that kind of detail will make a difference. I don't know that it speaks to the principal differences in the way these systems operate. As the regions get bigger, I guess what you would call local representation gets less plausible. I'm not sure that it speaks to the kind of principal decision in terms of choice that you need to make. You know what the consequences of a system with constituency and regional members are going to be. Those regional members will represent a bigger or smaller region. Very unlikely it's going to be less than probably numerically about a seventh of the province. But I don't think it's necessary to answer that question in terms of the basic operating modalities of the two kind of systems.
Shoni.
On that same slide that Brad was looking at, in describing MMP, you said aiding small parties and STV with smaller parties. Did you mean to distinguish? Is that two distinct? Is there a difference there? Or
probably not.
Okay, good, and thank you for a question of clarification. And RB, a question of clarification.
Yes, please. I think MMP aiding small parties and STV aiding independent and smaller parties. In that regard...
RB, we can't hear you.
Oh, is that right? Sorry. I'm referring to this STV, MMP, and party competition slide, where we say MMP aiding small parties and STV aiding independents and smaller parties. I think when we say this, in MMP, the constituency seats are easier for independents than STV districts or regions or whatever you call them. And especially if, imagine DM going up to 7, it can be a huge area for independent to try. That's one point.
I think that was kind of the essence of Brad's question.
Okay. Idioti.
Before we go into voting, I have one question. Maybe Chair can clarify that. Since almost the very first meeting of the Assembly, we have been given the impression that our term of reference would not allow us to change the number of seats. And I have also heard the concern of people from rural and remote communities not wanting larger constituencies. If we were to recommend MMP, either rural constituencies would get larger or we would have to increase the number of seats. I was reading the term of reference the other day, and I didn't see anything reference to not being allowed to make the legislative assembly larger? Are we or aren't we allowed to recommend increasing the number of seats? And where can I find this information? Thank you.
Our mandate is to stay with 79 seats. On the other hand, when we discuss the section called Other Considerations, we might want to make comment on that at that time. But 79 seats is what we work with, if I got the question right. Okay? Julie.
Quick question with regard to the regions and Wilf's question and Ken's answer. I was trying to interpret or understand from what you said. Will we have an input into the region size? Because the regions you're referring to are the regions that would be reflected in the party list, the regional party list. So those are the regions.
Yeah, I think as we agreed this morning, Julie, that if the Assembly decides on MMP and if it decides to recommend MMP over the current system, then one of the details would be to say something about regional size.
Okay.
It would be
Thank
important
you.
To do that. They decided last weekend to kind of leave that. It was the principle of having regions that was critical.
Douglas.
I guess it's along that same line that I'm trying to get clarification. When we were looking at the MMP system last weekend, we did say that there were a few things that we have yet to make decisions on. And I just want to be clarified. Are we going to make that decision about whether it's STV or MMP for all of these different things before we decide on those fine details? I thought there was going to be something that we were going to decide prior to making our decision. I thought there was a few things we had yet to discuss about the MMP system and make a decision on before we make that decision. Clarify if I'm wrong.
My understanding of what we decided was we would defer those decisions, go with the STV MMP vote. Should MMP win, then we'll come back and fill in those details because those details were not that significant.
And those items that we had left off were these ones that are in finer print on slide 4?
Yes.
Of Ken's presentation?
Now, do I reflect the understanding of the group?
Okay, I just want to make sure that's right.
I have to consult the white-haired gentleman for one sec.
Me?
I think we're just about ready. Before we're going to go in discussion groups, I've also asked the discussion leaders to raise the whole matter of what you will say after the vote. You know, we always have to prepare kind of for votes and decisions, but you also have to prepare kind of the moments and the days after the decision. And the questions I put to them have, what will you say if you're a part of the majority? What will you say if you're a part of the minority? What would you like your friend to say if that person is part of the majority or minority? And these are not unimportant decisions because it will certainly affect how things are accepted and conveyed as we go forward. So we're going to go in discussion groups. Have coffee when you can. We'll come back here at 1:15 after lunch. Happy discussions.